Okay. So again, let me tell you, let me remind you where we are. We are trying to minimize a functional on the space of all functions. Okay? And then the trick is to say, well, if it's a minimum among all functions, it's in particular for any function h, it will be a minimum along all functions of the form y plus epsilon h. Again, if y is the absolute best, then for any function h which satisfies these conditions, so that y plus epsilon h will be within our, will satisfy our conditions, y should be extremal among all the functions of the form y plus epsilon h. Okay? That's all. That's the clever trick. So the problem used to be infinite dimensional. We wanted to minimize something over an infinite dimensional space of y's. So you're on video.
Oh my god.
So now the problem became, it became a huge collection of finite dimensional problems. Or, you know, let me draw another picture to illustrate it. So suppose the problem was just two-dimensional. So suppose I had a function of two variables, y1 and y2, and I wanted to find an extremal point. Okay, I wanted to find a point which is on which some function j is extremal. So one thing I could do is I could say, well, if this function is extremal with respect to both variables, then in particular, if I go through this path in any direction I want, so if I look at the vector y, which is y1, y2, and I add to it epsilon times h, where h in itself is a vector, h1, h2, then in any direction I go, as a function of epsilon, this point should be a minimum when epsilon is equal to 0. Okay? So, the condition becomes, for every function h, well, not quite every function h, it should be a function defined on the relevant interval, it should be differentiable, but I'm not bothering to write it, and it should be such that y plus epsilon h is within our relevant space of functions. Meaning, y plus epsilon h should still satisfy the same boundary conditions. So therefore, h itself should have boundary conditions equal to 0. Again, I want h's so that when I add them to y, the condition of the boundary does not change. So, for all such h's, I want it to be so that the derivative of j, I want it to be so that j at y plus epsilon h will have a minimum at epsilon equal to 0, which is the same as saying that the derivative with respect to epsilon of this quantity at epsilon equals to 0 should be equal to 0. Okay? So that was the first sort of clever trick. Okay. But now let's compute this. The point is that this is computable. So let's, on the side, compute the derivative with respect to epsilon of j of y plus epsilon h, all of this at epsilon equals to 0. Well, first step is to copy. Okay? So I want the derivative with respect to epsilon of j. What is j? J is written over here. So it's the integral from a to b of f of x, and y plus epsilon h, and the derivative of y plus epsilon h. So it's y prime plus epsilon h prime. Integral with respect to x and quantity evaluated at epsilon equal to 0. So I hope you've seen I hope you've seen that under sufficiently good conditions, when you differentiate an integral, the result is the integral of the derivative. Okay? Basically, it's the fact that integration is a linear function. I mean, differentiate, well, basically it's the fact, well, okay, you know what, I will not attempt to prove it, I will just quote it. So this is the same as the integral from A to B as the derivative with respect to epsilon of f of x and y plus epsilon h, y prime plus epsilon h prime, dx, quantity evaluated at epsilon equals to 0. Okay? But now all I have is a derivative of a composite function. I'm differentiating with respect to epsilon a function of three variables, two of which depend on epsilon. Okay? So this is equal to the integral from A to B of, well, in principle, I should be writing the derivative of f with respect to its first variable times the derivative of the first variable with respect to epsilon times the change in the first variable as epsilon changes, so it's times 0, so I don't care about it. Okay? But then I have to add the derivative of f with respect to its second variable times the rate of change of the second variable. The rate of change of the second variable is h. Okay, or if you wish, the internal derivative within the second variable is h, because I'm differentiating a linear thing. Okay? So, f2 times h plus the derivative of f with respect to the third variable times h prime. Times h prime. Okay? And, well, this quantity is integrated dx, and I evaluate it at epsilon equal to 0. What does it mean that I evaluate it at epsilon equals to 0? So, first of all, what do I mean by f2? What I mean by f2 is the derivative of f with respect to the second variable evaluated at the point that I care about. So, at x, comma, y plus epsilon h, y prime plus epsilon h prime. Likewise, f3 is f3 of the same thing. But now, when I set epsilon to be 0, these simply drop out. So I will just get the integral from a to b of the first term I don't even have to copy. The second term is the derivative of, is f differentiated with respect to the second variable, evaluated at x, y, and y prime, times h, plus f3 evaluated at the same place, times h prime, dx, and I no longer need to write the at epsilon equals to 0. That's understood. That's been taken care of. Okay? Okay. The next thing is to use integration by parts. So the next step is by integration by parts. So you get the integral from A to B of F2, and now I will fail to say where it is evaluated. It's evaluated in the usual place. Times h, and then when you integrate by parts, the prime goes from here to here, right? So you get d to dx of f3 times the h. But, you know, when you integrate by parts, you get a minus sign. And finally, there is a boundary term. What is the boundary term? So here I should be adding a boundary term. But what's the boundary term? The boundary term is f3 times h evaluated at the endpoints a and b. Right? That's integration by parts. But at the endpoints, h is equal to 0. So this is equal to 0 because h of a is equal to 0 and h of b is equal to 0. So I don't need to worry about the boundary term. The boundary term drops out. And this is the end of the story. Well, sorry, this is the end of this equation, not of the story. The story continues. So, sorry, let me skip to this blackboard. And what do I get? I get, okay. So now notice that h appears on both terms. So I'll just pull it out, okay? So I'll get the integral from a to b of f differentiated with respect to the third variable minus the derivative with respect to x of f differentiated with respect to the second variable. All of this multiplied by h, and now let me emphasize that h is a function of x. I switched the 3 and the 2. Sorry. You're right. Sorry. Typo. Dx. So now comes crucial point number, I don't know what. Sorry, there are lots of crucial points here. First crucial point was the idea. Second crucial point is somehow the use of the chain rule and then the use of the integration by parts. And now comes crucial point number 3. I want this integral to be 0, so this should be equal to 0. This should be 0 for every function h. Now, this is some function. This is some specific function for any given y. Okay, once I fix what my y is, so, you know, once y is known, I'm assuming that y is given, and I'm trying to tell you what will follow from the fact that it's an extremum. So y is given to you, and I'm assuming that it's an extremum. So this will be some specific function. I don't know, let's call it temporarily g of x. And it's a function that's computed in a complicated way from y. It's the function, well, you take the function f, you differentiate it in certain ways, you substitute y into it, but it's still a specific function. And I have the property that for every h, the integral of g times h should be 0. So, in other words, for every h, the integral of g times h must be 0. Integral from a to b. How could this happen? When could this be? I claim that this implies the only way you could have that the integral of g against anything, multiplied by anything, is equal to 0, is if g itself is 0. If g is equal to 0, then clearly this is true. And I claim that that's the only way it could be true. So I claim that this implies that g is equivalent, is equal to 0, is identically equal to 0. Proof, and the proof I don't even need to do it in detail, okay? So the function g is defined between a and b, and it is some function. Let's pretend it's not equal to 0 somewhere. Okay? pretend it's not equal to zero here. Okay? Now, all my functions are differentiable. The function f was assumed to be differentiable. I differentiated it. In fact, I told you I'll assume as many differentiabilities as you want. So even the derivative is differentiable. I'm substituting into it a function y, which is differentiable, and y prime, which in itself is at least continuous. Anyway, the resulting function g is continuous. So this function g is continuous. If it's not zero in some point, it's going to be non-zero in a neighborhood of that point. Furthermore, it's going to have the same sign in a small neighborhood of that point. Right? So take the function x, so this is g, and take the function h to be a function that's zero everywhere, and then has a little bump near that point, and then goes down to zero. So let this be h. And then the product of g and h will be a function with which the product will be again a bump function of equal sign, of uniform sign. Okay? The function g itself could have had places where it's positive and places where it's negative, and when you integrate, this could cancel. But when I multiply g by h, when I multiply g by a bump function that's near a specific point, I only see the values of g near that point. So I only see a uniform sign. So no cancellation can occur. So the only way the product of g with any bump would have zero integral is if g was equal to zero. So that's the end of my point. Okay? So g is equal to zero. Okay, so what? So the moral is that I got the Euler Lagrange equation. If y is an extremum, then g is equal to zero, but g was just a name for this. Then f2 minus d to dx f3 is equal to zero. But this is now a differential equation on the function y. Okay? So this is a ODE that y must satisfy. So I think I'll give one example and then, well, yeah, no, me, yeah, I'll give one example and then quit. Sorry, one example and one small slight change of notation and then quit. So remember the example where which I claimed is behind all of classical mechanics. And that example was the integral from A to B, so F, or rather J, was equal to, in fact, it was called calligraphic L. Let's not make things too confusing. So let me just switch back to the standard notation. So J will be the integral of M, of sorry, 1 half M y prime squared minus V of y. And this is the thing which should be integrated dx. So this is the function f. Or more precisely, this is f evaluated at x, y, and y prime. So what's the function f? So f as a function of three variables, first variable, second variable, third variables, I don't know, what should I call them? Let me call them u1, u2, and u3, is the following. It's 1 half m, the third variable squared, u3 squared, minus v times y. Y is just the second variable, so minus v times u2. Okay? So this is the function f. Now, I failed to tell you that this is called, this is the Euler-Lagrange equation. So let's figure out what is the Euler-Lagrange equation in our case. So, in our case, what is Euler-Lagrange? It's the first derivative of f derivative of f with respect to the second variable. So, the derivative of f with respect to the second variable is, let me just differentiate it with respect to u2. Well, the first term drops out, it's just constant, minus the derivative of v with respect to u2. So it's negative v prime of u2. What is the derivative of f with respect to the third variable? So I need to differentiate with respect to u3. So u3 is squared. The derivative of something squared is twice that thing. Okay? Times the 1/2, it goes away. So I get m u3. Okay? So what is our equation? So Euler-Lagrange is, well, I have to take f2 and evaluate it at x, y, and y prime. So I have to take the original f2 and substitute x into u, y into u2, and y prime into u3. So the first term, so f2 minus d to dx, F3 will become, so F2 will become negative V prime of Y. The second term will become minus D to DX. And now I substitute XYY prime into F3. F3 depends only on the third variable, and the third variable gets a y prime. Okay? So minus d to dx of m y prime. And this is my differential equation. Now, why do I feel that I blundered? No, I think it's right. Sorry, this is okay. Even the signs are fine. So let me rewrite this. So let me move the v prime to the, sorry, let me flip signs and move the v prime to the other side. So I'll get m times, well, the derivative of y prime is y double prime. So I get m y double prime is equal to negative v prime of y. That's a differential equation. At the moment, I have nothing to say about it. Well, but I will, okay? So, if you were physicists, you would call the second derivative of y the acceleration. And you would be calling m the mass. And you may have seen the fact that that if you have a potential, then negative, the derivative of the potential, is the force. So, physicists would call this the equation F is equal to ma. Okay? Now, Jordan will show you other examples. I will show you other examples later on, but at the moment, that's the that's where this example ends. Now, I wanted to make one more comment before I really, really stop. In reality, nobody writes the Euler-Lagrange equation the way I wrote it. Nobody writes it in this form. And the reason is that there is a better form, which initially looks more confusing, but after you get used to it, it's less confusing. Okay? So, f differentiated with respect to the second variable, well, f is really a formula in x, y, and y prime. So f differentiated with respect to the second variable is really f differentiated with respect to y. And then, minus d to dx, and then f differentiated with respect to the third variable, well, the third variable f is y prime, of f is y prime. So this is the derivative of f with respect to y prime. Now, this notation, and this is the Euler-Lagrange equation, this notation is horribly confusing. Because what does it mean to differentiate f with respect to a derivative? How do you differentiate with respect to a derivative? It sounds like it sounds like I've invented new mathematics, completely kind of. But it does have a meaning. And the meaning is, well, when I write y prime here, I don't really mean the derivative of y. I mean the third argument of the function f. And as such, it's just ordinary derivative with respect to the third argument. So one last example before I quit. So remember the Brachistochrone. Brachistochrone. So for the Brachistochrone, the function f was the square root of 1 plus y prime squared divided by, well, well 2gy, but 2 and g are constant, so it is, it don't matter. So I'll just divide by y. Okay? So what's Euler-Lagrange here? So Euler-Lagrange is the following. So I have to take this f, so it's f differentiated with respect to y. What's f differentiated with respect to y? With respect to y, it's just the derivative of 1 over square root. It's negative 1 half, right? 1 over square root is y to the power negative 1 half. So the derivative is negative 1 half times y to the 3 halves, which amounts to saying the square root of 1 plus y prime squared divided by y cubed. Right, I'm putting the square root so it becomes y to the 3 halves. So this is fy minus d to dx, and now I have to write f differentiated with respect to y prime. And again, f differentiated with respect to y prime initially looks scary. But really, it just means take this formula and think of y prime as a single blob and differentiate with respect to it. So what do you get? Now I'm differentiating a square root, so I first, but there is an internal derivative as well. So first of all, let's multiply by internal derivative, by the internal derivative. This is 2y prime, right? I'm differentiating y prime with respect to, I'm differentiating y prime squared with respect to y prime. I get 2y prime times, well, 1 half from differentiating the square root. So in fact, these two will cancel. Times, the square root of 1 over, so the y stays because it's just a constant, and this goes from the numerator to the denominator because the derivative of square root is 1 over, is 1 half times 1 over the square root. So here I'll get 1 plus y prime squared. End of story. Okay? So this is the differential equation. And sorry for going way over time, But it really was a very bad place to stop. So, yeah, okay, no. Questions? Yes.
Okay, why is the square on the outside of the bracket?
Square root on the outside of the bracket?
And the square.
Which square?
On the last one.
Here?
The one you just wrote.
Here? Ah, because it's a mistake. Other questions? Yes?
So we showed that if y is an extremum, then the Euler-Lagrange equations are satisfied. Do we know that if the Euler-Lagrange is satisfied, that includes that y is an extremum?
No. So it's the same issue as in ordinary differential calculus. So in ordinary differential calculus, if the derivative is equal to zero, it's not necessarily a minimum, it's a candidate for a minimum. Okay? But typically, you will have that there will only be finitely many candidates for minimas in calculus. In ordinary calculus, you get that you have finitely many candidates for minimas, and then you have to study each one individually, maybe using the second derivative, maybe using other means. Okay? And the same is going to happen here. So, the original question was to search for something not only among infinitely many things, but within an infinite dimensional space of things. It's completely impossible. But then we found that the thing we're looking for has to satisfy a differential equation. The differential equation will reduce the number of possibilities to finitely many. In fact, most often in the examples I will give, it will reduce the number of possibilities to one. Okay? But and then that one or finitely many you'll have to study individually. How? Either by brilliance in each individual case or by developing sort of second variation techniques, by developing techniques to like this was first derivative, you have to look for techniques to study somehow second derivatives. This we will not do. Okay, so we will stick to finding finitely many potential solutions and never actually verify that these solutions work. After all, the only reason I'm introducing it is to motivate differential equations. This is sort of one of the best sources for why differential equations matter. One of the best reasons why differential equations matter. Other questions? Okay, so let's stop here. And again, I'm sorry for going over time, but it really was a bad time to stop.